I'm Larry Morrow, and this is Take Two, the radio program that looks inside a person's adventure, not so much from the outside in, but the inside out. In the next 30 minutes, you will discover the inward joy of his heart that married him to the passion of his life and the affirmation of ideals that directed his success. And in my time in Cleveland, investigative reporting became the norm, but the ones who did the investigating were not. What I mean by that is when you think of investigative reporters in this town, over the last three decades, only one name comes to mind, and there is a reason for that, which you will discover over the next 30 minutes. Welcome, Carl Monday. How are you, Carl?
Larry, it's always great to be with the legend. The Duker, Larry Morrow.
That's a moniker that I've had since the day I arrived in Cleveland, you know, when
can't live it down. And, you know, I know this is being broadcast on, at least in part, on WHK. And it occurred to me that that was my first job out of Kent State, out of college. Mm-hmm. Close to 50 years ago.
As far as I know, there are only two very popular TV personalities who ever wore an iconic trench coat, Lieutenant Columbo and you. And actually, you were the first, and Columbo copied you. Do you still have it?
I have several of my trench coats. Just it's like Slider, who's the mascot for the Indians. There's really more than one Slider. There's probably eight of them. There was more than one trench coat. I probably had six or seven. I don't think I have the original one, but I do have several of them. And I think the trench coat is more infamous than I am, actually, because you know, I did a story, this was back when I was on Channel 3, and it kind of caught the attention of a national audience. The Daily Show came in town to confront me. They sent one of their people down dressed in a trench coat to confront me at 7 o'clock in the morning. They did a little skit to kind of mimic my reporting style. And it caught on, and all these websites across the country picked up on the Carl Monday trench coat idea. I was getting pictures from somebody sent me pictures from Chicago. They were having Carl Monday Halloween parties, and people were dressing up in their trench coats. Deadspin, which was a sports blog, I think it's still in existence. They started a Carl Monday day at the whatever the minor league ballpark was down in Florida, and if you had a mustache, you got in free. Well, if you wore a trench coat, so mm-hmm. Yeah, I know one trench coat we auctioned off at the WVIZ public television auction, and it was projected that it would, you know, attract maybe bids of, you know, into the thousands of dollars. Well, it kind of brought me back down to earth because somebody paid $75 for it. So, so it wasn't as valuable as I thought it would be. But, yeah. You know, while we're on the subject, you know, how did I start wearing a trench coat? It was part of the uniform when I started in investigative reporting back in the All the President's Men's days, you know, for the movie. That was just part of the uniform that we wore. And my idol at the time was, and I've got plenty of stories about him, but Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes. I figured if he can wear a trench coat, so could I. the problem is, you know, it caught on to such an extent that when I was at Channel 19, my news director, Dan Salamone, and the promotion department, and I know I'm rambling here, but they were so insistent that I wear the trench coat virtually year round. I mean, I'd be doing stand-ups in July, and they'd want me in my trench coat. They shot all my promos in a trench coat, and then we were doing at one of the Cavs games at halftime. We were doing a charity quickie basketball game to raise money for charity. This was at a Cavs game, and my news director, again, Dan Salamone, I had my gym trunks on and my basketball shoes, and I'm running up and down the court in my trench coat at the queue. So, yeah. Yeah, it's almost again part of the uniform, and it almost became a cliche after a while. But the long-winded answer to your short question is yeah, I still have some of my trench coats.
Well, you know, back to Colombo for a second. Obviously, he stole that idea from you, but the two of you are similar in a way. He won 4 Primetime Emmy Awards and a Golden Globe Award, but you, Carl Mundy, have won 150 national, regional, and local awards. Your 13 Emmys for investigative reporting are tops in local Emmy history. Does that embarrass you at all when you hear that?
No, as a matter of fact, I've got one right here.
Too bad they can't see us on television. He's holding up that beautiful Emmy.
Yeah, I didn't think you would ask. I think it's a validation. I think at any given time, any given year, somebody who's been in the business for a while is going to win, you know, their fair share of awards. I think it's the consistency of awards. If you win them in most years, I think it just shows that you're putting a good product out there, and that that in the eyes of your peers who do the judging in most cases, mm-hmm. in all these awards, that they appreciate what you're doing. We get all the glory, but there's a lot of people behind the scenes. I know it sounds like an acceptance speech, but there's so many producers and editors and photographers that I work with that they've won their share of Emmys too, but they're without them, you know, you couldn't do the job, right, at the same level that we hope to achieve.
You know, Carol, you were the first television reporter inducted into the Cleveland Press Hall of Fame. And if that's not enough to burst all the buttons off your celebrated coat, your reports have appeared on CBS, CNN, Geraldo, and CBS Primetime Magazine. Shame on you. Carl, I know you, and you are a very, very humble guy. When you hear things like that, what does it do to you?
I think it's great to get the exposure, not so much for me, but for the stories. Some of the stories that appeared on these national shows started off as just local stories. They weren't the Pentagon Papers. They were stories about individuals or government agencies here in the city of Cleveland or in greater Cleveland. And it caught the attention in each case of, a national producer or somebody on that level. We were invited to be on these national shows. And the good part about it is as you gain exposure as a reporter, a young reporter, it attracts other people, not only other viewers, but other sources. They feel confident that you can present their story in a factual way and get results. And one story leads to another, and it gets to the point where we had so many stories to work on that I missed big stories because I was so busy working on another story. I mean, I could just throw. I mean, we knew about the Demora Russo, corruption mm-hmm. going on with the county, we just could never put enough time into it to prove it. And I think that's something that sometimes the audience maybe, and for good reason, they wouldn't quite understand. But sometimes you can spend 6 months on a story and come up empty-handed. And I remember spending a year on a story, not every day, but over the course of a year. And sometimes you need that little nugget, that little fact, that one document, the one eyewitness, the one source, and it fails to happen, and the story never hits the air. Sometimes we'd get, well over 100 tips a week, and out of those 100 tips, maybe you'd land up working on 20 of them, and maybe 2 of them would eventually hit the air. So part of the process was trying to separate the wheat from the chaff and try to figure out what do I spend time on.
I'm Larry Morrow, and this is Take Two, and we're talking with Cleveland's one and only Carl Mundy. You know, Carl, I'm a lucky guy because when you showed up at my door with Avery Friedman, you came to pick me up and we all had to do an oldies rock concert. Others, on the other hand, saw you coming, ran to the back of the house, hid in the attic while screaming, "Oh no, it's Carl Mundy." So we've been lucky to discuss some of the light things. Now, your name, Carl Mundy, was initially an on-air pseudonym, but later became your legal name, didn't it?
People always ask me, well, how'd you come up with that name, or is that your name? And it is. It's been my legal name since 1972. I was at Kent State, and I actually started using the name in 1970. I was about to do a radio show on the campus radio station, and you know, we're all hanging around the dorm, and I was going to be on the air the next day, and I'm thinking, okay, what name am I going to use? And somebody suggested, well, how about Alexander Monday? And I says, well, there's already a Carl Alexander who's working in Akron or Canton. I said, I'd like to keep the name Carl. I says, well, what if I just use Carl Monday? And they said, well, yeah, that sounds fine. So I went on the air the next day on the campus radio station as Carl Monday, and the name stuck. You know, that's what people started to know me as. And, you know, after consulting with my dear parents, they gave me the green light, gave me the blessing to change it legally. I know a lot of people in this business live their lives with two names, but I just never saw the sense of it. And I do have a couple of brothers that carry on the my original name of Stalinski from Slavic Village, the Polish community in Cleveland. Today, I probably would have kept the name, because I think it's almost an asset to use your original name. But I'm stuck with it, and I'm Carl Monday, and my wife is Sandy Monday, and
that's it.
What was the joke about if Carl Monday had married Tuesday Weld? Forget it.
You know, Carl, the reverse happened to me when I went to CKLW, which is one of the big stations in America. I was so excited because I was going to be able to use my real name, Larry Morrow. And I'll never forget, the program director walked in about 15 minutes before I went on the air, and he said, Larry, we've got a great idea. Since we're in Windsor, Ontario, we're going to call you Duke Windsor. And I said, what? Duke Windsor? And you're going to make, and so, you know, I use that name, obviously, because I had to. But I came on the air and I called myself the Duker. So now the Duker has lasted all these years. But thank God when I came to Cleveland, I was able to get my real name back. So that was nice. You just mentioned Slavic Village. So let's take it back to the beginning. As well as I know you, I have no clue of your early beginnings other than what you just mentioned, that you grew up in Slavic Village. But you attended Garfield Heights High School. Let's take it back to that. Now, you're a young guy, and did you have any inkling at all that one day you would be on television?
Well, I mean, looking back, I think the answer is yes. Maybe not necessarily television, but I knew I'd be in the communications business. You know, I grew up in Slavic Village, really kind of a special place to me, at least in my heart. I know the neighborhood's not the same anymore, but I grew up at 6723 Siebert Avenue, which Siebert Avenue is one block north of Fleet Avenue, if you're familiar with Slavic Village. You know, I delivered the Cleveland Press there, so I was already spreading the news, so to speak. I played at baseball at Morgana Park, went to St. Stanislaus Grade School through eighth grade. I was an altar boy there and for about 5 years. And, you know, I think it all goes back to my parents because of their upbringing and their background. I think between the nuns, the sisters over at St. Stanislaus, and my parents, I developed a really kind of a strong sense of right and wrong, of you know, black and white, not in the truest sense, but just the difference between what's right and what's wrong. There was never ever in between with my parents. Either something was right or something was wrong. But that upbringing, and people ask me, well, who influenced you most? And I have to say my mother. My father was very artistic and a very hard worker and everything, but my mother just had this gift of gab. And, you know, we used to play ball on the streets on Siebert Avenue, and the neighbors would call the police officers, and my mother would come out, and she would, for lack of a better word, would argue with the police officers that we had no other place to play. And then the officers would finally agree with my mother and drive off. Well, one day my mother wasn't home and somebody called the police on us, and the police arrived, and I went up to the police car, and the guy says, we were playing football, and the officer says, where's your football? I says, what football? He says, well, we saw you throwing it in the shrubs while we were driving up, which I had done. But anyway, I started trying to reason with the cops and started raising my voice, kind of like my mother did. And they summarily put me in the back of the cruiser and took me down to the police station. So yeah, I think that kind of self-righteousness maybe that my mother had. And also growing up, I remember, you know, when there was an incident or there, you know, the fire department arrived on our street or something, I'd be the first one to run down the street and try to find out what happened and try to tell the rest of the folks on the street. But when I was 14, we moved to Garfield Heights. That's when we moved to Garfield. Mm-hmm. And, I decided I was, you know, begrudgingly was going to go to the public schools, and I went to Garfield Heights, junior high and high school. And that's where, I think I, you know, planted the seeds really, you know, to pursue a career in, not necessarily in television, either in the broadcasting or entertainment business, because I was very interested in the music business, as you were, Larry, and are. But I knew that it would have been in one of those two fields, and I started writing for the high school newspaper. I was the sports editor for the paper. I used to MC all the sports assemblies at the high school, and and when I was still in high school, I was starting to work for an FM station, WXEN 106.5. I was doing some newscasts while I was still in high school. So to answer your question, yeah, by the time I got out of high school, I pretty much knew, you know, what direction I was going into. Not exactly what I was going to do, but I had a pretty good idea it was going to be something in the field of information or entertainment.
Now, Carl Mundy, I read where you started investigative reporting by leaking the roster list of the Garfield Heights High School Bulldog baseball team. Then you decided to publish it in the Mirror School newspaper. You're a rascal. You know that, don't you?
Well,
that had to be, Carl, you know, where it all started for the most part.
Well, yeah. I mean, back, you know, today, I mean, that's what you do. If you're a sports editor or a sports reporter, that's the kind of reporting you do. But back then, I guess that was it was out of bounds, and I got called down to the principal's office, and the baseball coach, who also happened to be my math teacher, tried to get me suspended because he said I destroyed the morale of his team because I had before the season even started, I decided who was going to be start. But I knew all the baseball players, so I wasn't just making this up. I had good information.
Now, Carl, from Garfield Heights, now you go to Kent State University. And speaking of Kent State, in the wake of the May 4th tragedy, also known as the May 4th Massacre or the Kent State Massacre, if you will, you served as correspondent for dozens of radio and TV outlets across America. Is that where you really got the investigative bug? Because at this point in time, the whole part of America is looking at Kent State. And now you're the guy, you're the one doing the reporting. What did that do for your career, Carl?
Well, I think it changed the direction of my career. 2 days before the Kent State shootings, on the Saturday of that weekend, I was spinning records on my all-request Saturday night show, talking to all the chicks from the dorms and everything, having a good time. And then we get a phone call saying, hey, look out your back window. It looks like the campus is on fire. And I go to the back window, and sure enough, the ROTC building had been torched. And it mm-hmm. really looked like the entire campus was up in flames. That really did change my focus. And I was fortunate enough, somebody that I had met at the Kent State television station also worked for the University News Service at Kent State. And he asked if I was interested in working there. And a few months later, I began working at radio TV information, which normally would be just like a PR job for the university. But because of what happened there, and the interest was so high across the country for information from Kent State, that I just kind of fell into this job where I was actually an on-air correspondent, mostly for radio stations. I did a few TV, but you know, throughout the country, I would be doing stories for and supplying voice reports, and yeah, it was a big boon. It really, and when it came time to get a job after college, I just already had some contacts and pretty had a good idea what direction I was going.
You know, this interview, as you mentioned earlier, runs on WHK 1420, and that's sort of where you got your start, isn't it, Carl?
Well, it is. Yeah, I was. It was my last quarter or last semester. I can't recall at Kent State, and you know, I reached out to a number of radio TV stations, and I kind of wanted to stay home for a while, go back to Cleveland, and I had a firm offer to go to WHK. They were owned by Mulright back then, which Mulright, of course, is very active with the Jewish Heritage Museum now in Cleveland. But they owned WMMS and WHK. They were in the old Agora building on East 55th. And I only worked there 6 months, but I, you know, really learned a lot and did a little bit for MMS, but mostly for WHK. And that job propelled me to another station, WERE, and that job was really the foundation for what I did, because it was a very aggressive kind of a populist journalism where we, you know, were fighting for the little guy. And I think that's where I started to, you know, really get my groove on, so to speak, and start to make somewhat of a reputation. I did a little bit of everything. In fact, I was the news director for a while, but that's where I began doing investigative reporting. And one of the stories I did, just to show you how wacky things were, we got a tip that a Cleveland school official was involved with some mobster in New York. So somehow I got a hold of this guy, this mobster guy, and he says, "Yeah, come to. I'm on Long Island. Come on down to, and we'll talk." So I go down there and I get off the train, and he's got a car waiting for me, the stretch limousine, and I go to some shady looking building factory, and I walk inside, and he has me stripped down to my underwear, and I get patted down and everything, and here I am, you know, some young radio guy, just trying to gain some experience. While other guys were reading Wire copy, I'm in some warehouse with some mobster in my underwear. What was I thinking? But I'm here to talk. I'm still here to talk about it. So that's the good thing.
Aside from all of the well-deserved accolades, you do charitable work with several nonprofit organizations, including the Cleveland Food Bank, the Downtown Historic Warehouse, as well as NATIS, which is the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Carl, you've been blessed with this moniker, Dean of Cleveland Investigative Reporters, simply because you set the standard for investigative reporting with three different television stations in your six-decade career. And you're still pushing it a little bit, aren't you? I mean, you're on WJW now, currently.
Yeah, I retired officially, unofficially, 2.5 years ago. When I went to work for Channel 19, they said, "Can you give us 3 years?" And I landed up working 12 years. So it was time to go. But then Fox 8 called. We did the 40th anniversary of the I-Team a couple of months later. And then they said, "Well, how would you like to do a story like during the rating periods? Maybe you'd do a story for us every rating period, every 4 months or so, or 3 months." I said, "Yeah, I'll give it a shot." And we've been trying to do that. So yeah, I still have my hands in. I probably work every day on some story or not, or somebody calls me and I'm making phone calls. I feel like I'm still working full time half the time. But if I get some stories that maybe I can't work on, I pass it along to to Fox 8. But it is tough to let go because, Larry, you know, it's just such, it was really what I did, not only what I did, but really who I am. And quite frankly, it is hard to let go. Fortunately, I got a great wife, Sandy, and, you know, we've done some traveling. COVID kind of put a stop to that, but we're, you know, otherwise enjoying the semi-retirement.
Yeah. You know, Carl, you've been blessed with the moniker Dean of Cleveland Investigative Reporters simply because you set the standard for investigative reporting with three different television stations in your six-decade career. What you have accomplished in all of your years in front of a camera is not only valued, but essential. And, you know, your sense of loyalty to your craft elevated you to a sense of admiration only few ever rise to. And what I love most about you, Carl Mundy, is that you push the boundaries for all in television to follow. Thank you, my friend, for our time together. It has been very special. So I don't think I'll ever spend another hour with anyone more treasured than you, my friend.
Larry, thanks so much for having me. Love you, guy.
Okay, same here. So until next time, do all the good you can to everyone you can every time you can. For Take Two, I'm Larry Morrow.